Jensen presents the Keith Lowell Jensen Show with Keith Lowell Jensen.
Oh my goodness, here we are at episode 15, and what a week it has been. It feels weird to just be recording a, you know, an arts and culture podcast when Megalomaniacs stormed the Capitol last week. And I'm starting to think that telling people that your political opponents are running an international pedophile ring out of pizza parlors when they're not killing babies and pushing America towards communism and Sharia law might be a bad idea, might be a little dangerous, because these guys freaked out, man. But the NRA showed that they won't be swayed as they fired off their first batch of "They're Coming to Take Your Guns" fundraising emails just today. Same old behavior. I'm guessing too many folks from their staff were arrested or laying low from the FBI or something, though, because they didn't even have time to write new emails this time around. They actually got caught recycling their four-year-old emails from the last time Joe Biden hung out in the White House, just switching his name in place of his buddy Barack's. So very weird week behind us and weird weeks ahead. It would have been awkward not to acknowledge it. But again, this isn't a political podcast. So I want to get to introducing this week's guest. But first, I've got to, and I get to, thank our sponsor, Burley Beverages. They're at burleybeverages.com, and Burley is spelled B-U-R-L-Y. They make artisanal gourmet soda syrups and old-timey shrubs. Later in this episode, my producer, Joe, and I are going to sample some of Burley's good stuff. But for now, know that you can get 15% off of your order online or at the Burley Tasting Room on Del Paso Boulevard in Sacramento, California, by using the discount code KLJRULES, and rules is spelled with a Z. I didn't do that. They did that. It feels weird saying KLJ rules. One time a friend of mine wrote a love letter for me to give to a girl, and the friend that wrote it was a girl, and she put all this stuff in there going like, "I'm one of the coolest kids in fourth grade." And I was like, I can't give that to her. You can't say that about yourself. And that's how I feel now, again, with Burley making KLJ rules, the 15% discount code. But, you know, whatever, use it. You'll get 15% off. Cool. My guest today is a friend of mine, a very talented and interesting man, Dan McCoy. How you doing, Daniel?
I'm doing fine. How you doing, Keith?
I'm doing great. Let me tell them who you are, okay?
Okay.
Daniel McCoy began his career with Pixar Animation Studios in March of 1989, working with the RenderMan software group for 8 years. McCoy has been a part of the shading team on a number of Pixar's award-winning feature and short films, including Jerry's Game, A Bug's Life, Toy Story 2, Monsters, Inc., Finding Nemo, Up, Ratatouille, and Toy Story 3. McCoy was the supervising technical director for the Academy Award-nominated short La Luna, which was released theatrically in 2012 in front of the Disney Pixar feature Brave. He's currently developing new shading tools with Pixar's Software Tools Group. Prior to coming to Pixar, McCoy worked with NASA, Ames Research Center, and at Sun Microsystems as part of their computer graphics group. A native of San Jose, California, McCoy attended San Jose University. Hello, Dan. You did a lot of stuff.
Yeah, that's, I guess, yeah. Yeah,
it'll be it sounds good on paper, doesn't it?
It sometimes scares me when I think about it. I've been at Pixar for, it'll be 32 years in March.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Now, you grew up in San Jose.
Yep.
And are you still in San Jose?
I moved back. I moved up to Marin when I started to work for Pixar, and because Pixar was up there at the time. Then okay. I moved to the East Bay, and I moved over to the East Bay, and then a few years ago, I got remarried, and my wife, even though her family's from Nashville, she, her son, daughter, son-in-law, and daughter-in-law all work for Google down here. So we moved to be close to the grandkids.
You guys are a very techie family.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's funny, too, because, you know, I'm the techie guy. They all four of them work for Google, and it's a English major, a film major, a history major, and an art major.
Okay. But they call you for tech support.
Google is a big umbrella for a lot of different things.
For sure. You know, speaking of tech, though, I wanted to ask you, what was San Jose like before the tech boom? Like, what was it like growing up in San Jose?
Oh, orchards, canneries, you know, and just it was kind of crazy. Orchards all over the place. I used to ride my bike around, and, you know, in the right time of year, you could just, you know, kind of go into some orchard when nobody's looking and just pick big cherries right off the tree and stuff. It was kind of a cool place. Go ahead.
I mean, you enjoyed growing up in San Jose.
It was good.
Did it feel kind of small towny to you?
It did. It had, but when I was a really little kid, it had a bit of a downtown feel to it, like it was a small town. And then the big shopping mall started killing the downtown, and then it turned into just sprawl and cars and
paved it over. What were you like then? Were you an early adopter of tech? Were you a nerdy kid who was into computers?
Well, it's kind of funny. I was a kind of a nerdy kid. I was, you know, excelling in math and science in school and stuff. But, you know, the computer, my last year of high school, the senior math teacher wanted to get us some experience on a computer, but our, you know, like school district didn't have a computer. She got them to buy this Wang brand programmable calculator that used those old 80 column cards and this sort of clamshell thing, and that you punched by hand with a little pencil through the chads and stick it in. And yeah, that was not very exciting. That didn't exactly thrill me.
What year is this?
This is I graduated high school in 69.
Okay.
Yeah, old fart.
That's but then, great.
Then I went off to San Jose State, but, you know, I rebelled. I ostensibly majored in philosophy, took nothing but humanities. In fact, one way of putting it, I took nothing but electives. But after 4 years, I found out they didn't give a degree in electives. So
so you should have been finishing up, and you
yeah, like
to pick something to add to that, huh?
I didn't have enough in any one basket, so I just went off to be a bartender.
Oh, that's funny. And you were telling me when you were bartending, it was the bar where tech comes back into your life. The Atari guys hung out. Is that right?
Yeah, Silicon Valley was starting to happen around there, and it was actually a rock and roll club. But I was the daytime bartender, and I would work some nights, you know, fill in on the big nights, but mostly lunches and stuff, and then happy hour. And it was not far from Atari, and all the Atari people had come. And they had a game room there, and Atari would, you know, try out their new mid-70s, you know, arcade games in our little room. And, you know, Nolan Bushnell would come in, you know, head of Atari at the time.
Right.
You know, and when they would bring out a new one, and he was horrible at them. You know, anybody could beat Nolan Bushnell at video games.
Oh, that's funny. He wasn't good at playing them, huh?
No. He was good at making money off of them, but not playing them.
And these were Atari games in a proper arcade cabinet, or they had like an Atari system hooked up there?
No, it was like I remember one they brought out was they had one they called it's a Grand Track, I think it was, and it had a, you know, it was a console that had a steering wheel and a pedal on it. And you were driving around this thing. Then they came out with a big splash, Grand Track 8, which had. Oh, nice. 8 steering wheels around, and it had a big CRT monitor, you know, mounted, you know, facing up. So you kind of look down on it, and everybody and 8 people could be around racing around this track. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, it was kind of fun. But, you know, it was like silly, you know, not realistic at all. It was like a little, you know, 16 pixel car kind of going around.
Right.
Yeah.
So how did you end up back in tech from being a philosopher bartender?
Well, you know, I worked at two different rock and roll clubs. I got tired of the first one, went to another one. And then that one went out of business. New Year's Eve, 1976. And, you know, at midnight, all of a sudden we stopped using the cash registers and just poured out the rest of the booze. It was over in Santa Cruz. But
wow, you're going to finish up your stock that evening.
Yeah, we're out of business. We're not just, it's over. You know, if they used the captures, they'd have paid taxes in 1976.
Right.
So they stopped it. So, but and then I was unemployed for a while, collecting unemployment and living in a house with a bunch of other people. And one guy was actually working, actually up at NASA Ames, you know, programming computers. He said, "You can do this stuff, Dan," and you know, showed me some stuff. So I went back to school at De Anza College, community college down here. And they had a self-paced course in Fortran, you know, back then, which where you had to like, punch your program onto cards and, you know, hand them over to an operator. They fed them in. You wait around and then, you know, the thing would come out the printer. But yeah, I dove into that. And I was unemployed, didn't have anything else to do. So they had their first course was self-paced. They had the lectures down in the library on tape. So I just went down and listened to one. Said, "Well, what the hell?" I just went down and nobody, you know, first 2 weeks, nobody's using the computer lab because everybody's busy finding their desks and stuff. Right. I finished the semester class in 2 weeks just because I would just stay there all day and just go back and forth.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. But after a semester of that, it turned out De Anza College had this internship program where you could work at NASA Ames half time. And I only realized later that the money they paid, it was like below minimum wage. And it was actually a loan, you know, because then after you worked your year there, you owed the money back that they had been paying you.
What?
They kind of gave you a loan and then they paid it out as if it was wages. It got me in the door at NASA Ames. And
oh, what a strange.
Yeah.
I've heard of free internships, but I've never heard of, okay, we'll pay you, but you have to pay us back.
Exactly. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. But, you know, it worked out well because I just got hired by a contracting company there. So I ended up there 5 years. And then the contracting company sent me out to some Silicon Valley company, Ramtech, which nobody's heard of before because they're long gone.
Did you do anything at NASA that you could explain to me and I would understand it?
At the time, you know, it was kind of fun. It was computer graphics at the time, and it was really high end stuff they had. You couldn't get it in school, but it was what they called stroke scopes, where rather than showing, you know, an image, the CRT, the little electron gun, would sweep out the lines that, you know, you programmed in. So it was drawing the lines on there. And so you could only do all the wireframe pictures. You couldn't do, you know, full images. But we would, it was in an aeronautics branch where they were doing testing of airplane models, you know, and they would send them off to the wind tunnels and stuff. And we would look at the models ahead of time, the mathematical models, and, you know, just visualize them, you know, tumble them in 3D, see what they look like. And
Stroke Scopes, I think, was going to be that originally was going to be the name for Pornhub.
I think the manufacturers actually called them calligraphic displays, but everybody called them a stroke scope. Yeah.
Stroke scope is much better.
Yeah. 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 Different stroke scopes for anyway. But yeah, that was so I learned a lot about, and then I, started working on they got something that would show full color images, you know, and it was this fancy box off to the side that was like 512 by 512 image and, you know, full color. And you try to put up an image that would like now there's your image, you know. It was like really amazingly slow back then, but no way you're going to do video, but it was fun. You know,
did
I got
it feel
to,
slow back then? Or were you like, oh my God, this is amazing? It only took 10 seconds.
Yeah. It was, you know, because there was nothing to compare it to, you know.
Right.
I had created this image on the computer and it actually showed it to me after 5 minutes. You know,
this is one
minutes.
Of the things. It's, you know, we often talk about like how far technology comes in one person's lifetime. You know,
yeah.
If somebody was 100 years old today, they would have seen blah, blah, blah. I can't believe how far things have come in just your career. I mean, that's incredible.
I know.
How did you end up going from NASA over to Pixar?
Well, you know, I did a little tour through Silicon Valley. I learned a bunch of graphics at NASA, and then Ramtech made graphic displays, so I did stuff there. And then I went to Sun Microsystems, which is the hot thing at the time. I was there for 2 years, and they doubled in size each year I was there.
Wow.
You know, it started up, I was employee number 2762, and they had over 10,000 employees by the time I left.
Wow.
But I had actually applied at Pixar in 1986 when they first started, and applied at Sun Microsystems at the same time and took the Sun Microsystems job.
Oh, okay.
And then after 2 years, I was kind of disillusioned, and I called up the guy. And it turned out the guy I'd interviewed at Pixar was a buddy of the guy I interviewed with at Sun Microsystems.
Oh, how funny.
So we had kept in touch, because like they got the two groups of like software engineers and stuff would get together in San Francisco and go to the Rockin' Bowl, you know, and we'd, you know, have little bowling competitions, you know, with rock music. But yeah, I ended up, you know, after 2 years, I called up the guy and said, hey, you got an opening now? And, you know, by that time, they had knew me by reputation from his friend. So I just waltzed in.
I got to stop and just – this is us old guys giving advice to young people. If anyone is listening, you had an interview for a job you didn't get, and you stayed friendly and cool and in touch with the person.
Yeah.
And then got the job. I have twice been rejected from comedy festivals and sent them a nice letter saying, hey, thanks for considering me. I'm still going to be there. I'm a big fan, blah, blah, blah. And then they sent me back a response saying, you know what? We actually do have a spot.
Nice.
You know, and then I've seen other people get their rejection letter or get told they're not going to be get the job, and they're like, "God damn it, you jerk!"
Right. Yeah. Don't burn bridges unless you want to work for a bridge burning company or something.
That could be a lucrative career.
Yeah.
So, what was Pixar working on at the time that you started working with them?
It was kind of straight back in the 80s. Well, you know, Pixar had originally been Lucasfilm Computer Division, and George Lucas had this idea that, oh, maybe these computer guys can find ways to make it easier to make movies, and he hired a bunch of these tech people, and they put this group together, and they ended up, their pride and joy was they designed this box. You know, then you couldn't do this stuff on a laptop. You had to have like a mini computer. And then there was this other thing the size of a small refrigerator you stuck next to it that would do the graphics. You know, and they did this one that would process images called the Pixar Image Computer. Way expensive and stuff, but it could, you know, it was really hot stuff by the time. But nobody in the movie industry could afford it. And the only people that were buying it was medical imaging people. Nowadays, you go to a doctor and they do a scan. He'll bring it up on his laptop and rotate it around and all that stuff.
Sure.
You needed one of these boxes to be able to look at those scans back then.
Okay.
So Lucas was not interested in that. So he was going to just shut it down. And the Pixar people said, well, can we look for a buyer, you know, who'll spin it off?
When you say the Pixar people, was Lasseter one of these people?
Yeah, Lasseter, he was kind of the creative guy. But the main guys were Ed Catmull and Alvy Ray Smith, were two tech guys who started it. And they hired, you know, Lasseter. And he had done, you know, some animation stuff, and they'd done a few special effects for Lucas and stuff, but this whole medical imaging thing was just boring. But they talked to Steve Jobs, and Steve Jobs bought it off of George Lucas. So
I knew that Jobs had a role in, I thought, in the founding earlier on. I had no idea of Lucas's role. That's amazing.
Yeah, Jobs was the one it spun off to. And then, you know, I originally interviewed, they were less than a year old. They were just a few months old, and they wanted me to do something to, the reason I went to Sun is because what they wanted me to do is write a, what they call a device driver, the system software that would plug a Pixar image computer into a supercomputer. And it's like, it wasn't that interesting. But, you know, the 2 years down the line, they're still trying to make their money selling these Pixar image computers. And they had field offices around the country. There were about 100 employees and, you know, most of them in San Rafael at the time. And I came in to work on this rendering software that was kind of a sideline. they wrote some software that would render high quality images that they used for some of the early shorts they made. When I was started there, they were working on the one called Knickknack. It's got a snowman and a snow globe.
Yeah.
They were working on that. And they had finished Tin Toy, the one they won the Oscar for. So the first Pixar event party I went to was the, hey, we won an Oscar for Tin Toy.
Oh, that's great. And were you, because I'm going to see where this overlaps with my own story at this point. Were you aware of Spike and Mike's Festival of Animation at that time?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, I'd gone to see Spike and Mike a few different times, you know, down in.
That's where I first saw all the early Pixar shorts.
Yeah, that was the only, you know, unless you went to the big computer graphics conferences or a few other places, that was the only way most people could see them was Spike and Mike. They got so much animation out there in front of people that wouldn't have a way to find it. You know, you couldn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. You couldn't get it on a, you know, back then be VHS or something.
I'll throw a quick plug in. Anyone listening, if you go back a couple episodes, I had Spike on along with Kat Alyoshin, who made a documentary about Spike and Mike. And some of the another angle on some of the same history that me and Dan are talking about.
Yeah.
So you come in, and this is way pre Toy Story.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It sounds like they weren't even doing animation was just a little sideline.
They actually called it the research group. They were researching how you would do animation, and they would just do a short every year. You know, and they did the Luxo Jr. and Red's Dream and Tin Toy and Knickknack. And then that year after I started, you know, and I was working on the software they used to render the images, but they hadn't really figured out a way to sell that stuff yet.
Okay.
They were just selling the hardware. And Steve Jobs comes along, you know, and Steve Jobs, you know, had bought it. And then every year they would be in the red and he'd write another check and just keep the lights on and everything. And he finally, we had this meeting in 89, later in 89, like, okay, guys, I'm tired of writing checks. You guys got to start paying your own way. And he said, we're going to sell off this hardware thing. It's just not working. And so they sold off the Pixar Image computer stuff. And then he said, the rest of you guys, animation, you have to, you know, figure out a way to make money, make commercials or something. And RenderMan guys, you got to, you know, sell that rendering software to other studios or end users or whatever. So we did. We kind of shifted, and the animation group that had been researched started doing commercials for like Listerine and Lifesavers and stuff.
Really? Any like cool, notable commercials that we might remember?
Well, there were some really good Listerine ones. They had one with where
no, like for real cool, or cool if you're like a nerd who's gonna be like, oh, that was cool. Really neat the way the mouthwash circled around the thing.
It's hard for me to tell what a non-nerd would think about it. Yeah. But it's like, you know, a Listerine bottle that's like, oh, it's based on raging, so he's like in a boxing ring and he's got boxing gloves knocking out gingivitis.
That sound cool. Yeah.
And there was one where he's Tarzan, and there's this mint Listerine that's swinging from a vine and going through. And there was a Robin Hood one where he's shooting arrows at a target. And there was a one where he's like General Patton. He's up on the giving a talk with a helmet on and has all these medals dangling from his chest. And I took a little break from the rendering software, and I modeled a bunch of those medals, you know, on his chest and stuff, just for, it's a fun thing. But
nice. You got to model being a Listerine bubble?
The medals on his chest, you know, like, you know, just for, you know, a medal for conquering gingivitis and
right.
tooth decay and stuff like that. But, you know, it was kind of fun. Some of those early ones were high. We were like the flavor of the month, and these high end things would come. And then it started spreading out, and we'd get some weird, like, you know, for All Brand and stuff to try. For not just All Brand, but for All Brand in Mexico. So we would do this, you know, thing where somebody would, you know, get bloated, and then All Brand would show up, and then they'd get unbloated. And it was like, oh, this is gross.
Right.
But at the same time, we were, like, when they were doing the research, they would just do one short a year. And it would take them, like, you know, it's like 2-3 minutes of animation, and it took them a whole year. They had to be on a schedule. They were short spots, but they had to get them done. And it was like training for for doing stuff. And they originally thought, man, it's going to be quite a lot to do a whole feature. Maybe we can do like a half hour special or something like that. And they talked to Disney, and they already had a relationship with Disney at that time because they had written some software for their Pixar Image computers that would do the compositing and ink and paint. And Disney switched over to doing all digital. They would the animators would still animate with pencils. Then they would scan it in, and everything after that was happening on an image computer. Starting with the very last scene in Little Mermaid, where the ship kind of sails off, that was done digitally. And then all the Disney films after that, they never use cells again. They'll still sell you collectible cells, but they print them out.
That's funny.
I shouldn't really say that. I'm in trouble now. But anyway, so we already had a relationship selling them this stuff to do their animation. And they approached them about Toy Story. And they said, oh, just do a feature film. You know, just go all the way. And so they hired a bunch of people. They had already hired a couple more animators. You know, started off with John Lasseter. And then they hired Pete Docter and Andrew Stanton.
So let me back you up a little there.
Yeah.
I want to know what it was like for you.
For me.
Working for this company to then get the news that you guys are going to do a feature with Disney.
It was kind of exciting.
I would think so.
And it was exciting partly in a way because we're always kind of hand to mouth as a company. It was like really tight. And it seems like, well, maybe this is a way we could actually make money.
Right.
And it worked out pretty well that way. And it was exciting to work on. I still remember, like, with Toy Story, after working on it a bit, before it was released, our offices were in Point Richmond then, and there was a couple little sandwich shops down in the downtown Point in Richmond. I was walking to go get lunch, and just by myself this time, because I was just going to get a quick sandwich and back. And I walked, and there in the gutter was like a Fritos bag with Woody on it. You know, like the merchandise was already coming out, the tie-ins and stuff, but the movie hadn't been released yet. And it was just, it's hard to describe that feeling to see like, oh, this thing I've been working on, is it already a piece of trash? We've become litter. We've made it into the culture.
Oh, that's funny. That's the ultimate, you know, never mind the Academy Award or whatever.
Yeah. Just,
that's great. I remember hearing, I think I first heard of it when I saw the first trailer, and I was already familiar with Pixar. And even though I liked Pixar, I was very skeptical that it could be done as a full feature. I was like, yeah. I don't know that I can look at, I felt like it lacked a certain warmth that I saw in cell animation. Mm.
Yeah.
And I just didn't know if that could carry the emotional oomph. And of course, then Toy Story comes out. Did you guys feel pretty sure? Like how confident were you guys? Was the vibe around Pixar when it was coming out? Was everyone let's see what it does? Or were you guys like, wait till the world gets a load of this?
Yeah, we knew we liked it, and we knew it was good in a certain way. But yeah, you don't know how people are going to respond, you know, because it looks so different.
It was very different. It's funny that now it doesn't stand out at all, but it looked so different to our eyes.
In fact, now if you compare it to the more modern ones, it looks kind of cheesy.
Right.
But it's because, you know, we did what we could at the time, but it was like something nobody had ever done before, so. It was like, we're just figuring it out as we went. And they pushed all the hard problems to the end. It's like, oh, humans, oh, God. They had like a – early on they were saying like, oh, maybe we can just see the humans from the toys' eye view so you don't see above their ankles. You know, and like, no, it didn't work out that way. You know, and okay, we got to do human skin and hair and all of the – it was really hard. So the humans are kind of unfortunate. But toys look great.
Yeah. And I remember being very aware of that as well. And then – being excited as Pixar started being able to have human characters.
Yeah. And they varied. There were like Toy Story 2, you know, depend like the Al, the toy collector, was kind of cool. Yeah. You know, he looked pretty good as a human, But man, there's a whole backstory for Jessie that her girl was she kind of came into the story late, and we didn't make a special model. They kind of grafted mom's head onto some other body, and it was like, and she, you know, you didn't want to look at her for very long. In fact, you don't see her face on when she's old, you know, old enough to be dropping off Jessie. But right. it worked. You know, you just show just enough as, and then as we kept going, and then Incredibles was like a real, like, okay, this is just all about these humans.
Right.
Luckily, they were very stylized, which kind of helped. But it was a really hard thing to do.
So try to explain to me what you do. What is shading? How does it differ from lighting and texture?
Texture is a big part of it. We put on all the surfaces in the show, we put on these special programs that talk, you know, that control what color it is, and they even add texture, like bump things, you know, if something's got some rough texture to it, it'll bump it up and down, and it defines how it responds to light, you know, and then the lighters come along and shine light on it. But this kind of says whether it's, oh, shiny metal, or it's like, you know, dull paint, or, you know, okay, something. And a lot of it is you come in and you make it, it's like, okay, this thing's plastic. You make it, it's this perfect plastic. And it's like, we don't want to look at a bunch of perfect plastic. If this kid's been playing with, it's just got to have scratches and dirt and, you know, all this stuff. So a lot of times we're putting subtle stuff on it, like beating things up and painting dirt and all that stuff.
Right. So it is what I'm thinking of, texture. That's what you do.
And a lot of it involves, you know, literally what they call texture maps, which are images that kind of get mapped onto the surface that carry some information. Sometimes they're just color, but sometimes they're special things to say where the dirt is or where the scratches are, or, you know, how the weave looks in a cloth or something.
Right.
And, you know, back in Toy Story days, it was all like really cheesy cartoon physics, essentially, you know, really fake. And as time has gone on, it's gotten more and more realistic, till now they're bouncing photons around and stuff, and it's just it's you know, kind of, there's a lot of real although we still always have cheats, you know, it'll do the real physics and say, yeah, we want to do all that, except right here we want to cheat, you know, and make it look like it's coming from over there. So
right, you're not bound by those rules. They're just there for you to use.
Yeah, and a lot of times you say, like, you know, we want it to look realistic in some world, maybe not necessarily this one, you know? And it's always a stylized world. It's different from this one. I mean, you see that really obviously when something like, you know, New Soul or Coco have these, or Inside Out, you know, have these other lands they go to that look very stylized and different. But it's just, you know, in Ratatouille, Paris, we didn't want to do real Paris. It was kind of this idealized, stylized Paris that, you know, just captured a feel that went with the movie.
Yeah, it was our idea of Paris.
Yeah.
So are you, and because we've kind of talked about your tech background, and then, you know, you studied some philosophy in college. Are you an artistic person when it's not digital? Do you paint, draw, sculpt?
I've done a little sculpting. I learned most of my art at Pixar. I was pretty much a pure tech guy when I got there, and I was software engineer. And more, they've always had art classes and stuff like that. And I, you know, signed up for them, and it was kind of interesting, like, when I was a kid, I had an older brother who everybody said was really good at drawing. And I was the young, I could never catch up with him. You know, so like, oh, he was the artistic one. So I kind of left it behind and went with the nerd. Okay. But then when I was at Pixar early on, they had this drawing teacher give a drawing class. And it was based on that. There's a book out, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. She was based on that. And one of the things they do there is you draw a self-portrait the first night. And then they give you all this training. And then as a final project, you do a self-portrait. Okay. And after this, the teacher, who was like an independent contractor, so she had did classes outside, she asked me if she could put my before and after on her brochure.
That's great. Because you sucked that much in the first one.
Yeah. And it's like, oh my God, I could do this. You know, and you know, I don't have enough practice, so I'm not like, there's a lot of different kinds of artists at Pixar, and like some of them, like the story artists, are really good at like quick sketching just to catch the a gesture or something like that.
Sure.
I'm not good at that. Like this, the self-worker is like painstaking going in and using a eraser and a pencil and yeah. So I can get there. I can see it, but it's it's not. It doesn't come easy to me because I didn't practice it for all those years before I got to Pixar.
Do you rub your brother's nose in it? You're the working artist.
He's not around anymore. So.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
There I go. Sticking.
Sorry. No, never mind. That's a long time ago. And shading, you know, like it, early on, it kept, I remember one of the first things, you know, when I was working on the software, I had to do, you know, something. And I remember going up to my stereo and seeing the brushed metal circle on the knobs, mm-hmm. you know, how, and I'm thinking, how do you do that? You know, right. And then, so I wrote a little thing that would do that. And then because it was, we're trying to recreate nature, started looking at things and seeing textures and things like, ooh, how does that go? And ooh, those colors. And after a while you have to get really attuned to colors and textures and stuff and just see them and know how to use them. And it's part of the job.
You sound exactly like a painter though. When you talk about breaking the world down like that.
Yeah, it's very, very similar. It just, the tools are very different. You know, I'm using, you know, really abstract tools rather than just, paint and a brush. But right. You have to understand color in a similar way and know what to do with it.
So a few years back, I got to come visit you mm-hmm. in Emeryville at the Pixar campus.
Yeah, we've done the repairs. It's okay now.
I need to come leave my mark again, you're saying?
Just kidding.
What an incredible place. As we were getting ready for this interview, I was thinking about the different artists that we saw, the concept artists and the storyboard artists, you know, because I think Coco was about to come out and Cars 3, I think, had already just come out.
Okay.
And so like half the main building is set up with all the art from Cars and the other half is set up with all the art from Coco.
That was a great time to come. The Coco art show was one of my favorite. Because we have these hallways where we always put up the making of kind of art for the current show.
Right.
And Coco was one of my favorites that way. It just had some beautiful stuff in it.
And all the sculptures and the development of the characters, and you can see early versions of the characters. It was really cool. What I was wondering is, how do all these different people at Pixar, like how much do you guys interact with each other? How much do you guys operate completely independently of each other? Like what's the Pixar family like there on the campus?
Well, yeah, I haven't been on the campus in 10 months. Hardly any of us have.
Yeah.
Because of the pandemic, which is kind of crazy.
Are you guys continuing to work?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Soul just, you know, came out. It's only on Disney Plus now because the theaters aren't open. But, well, it's in theaters, in places where theaters are open, like China and stuff. But yeah, it's got a credit at the end, you know, about made at Pixar in Emeryville, end at, you know, homes throughout the Bay Area, at least 6 feet apart. You know, it's kind of a fun little credit. But yeah. It's kind of strange now because we're doing a lot of Zoom meetings and everybody's working at home. But we were set up for it and it's just worked. It's pretty amazing. We miss each other and miss the in-person meetings and seeing stuff, but it's working.
And what about when the voice actors come in and when you're actually recording, do they come to the campus there in Emeryville and do you interact at all?
Sometimes a lot of the recording they do in LA, you know, cause they're fitting in the schedules of the actors and stuff. And so particularly the big names, they'll be sometimes LA, sometimes New York for Finding Nemo. They did some recording. Some of them were in Australia, you know, doing it and stuff. But occasionally you see them come around, you know, like I have told Tom Hanks where to find the bathroom before. That was one of
I'm sure he remembers you. You always remember someone that helps you in your time of need.
Yeah.
I had a manager that I wanted to work with And she saw me perform at a comedy festival, and I thought I did pretty well. But where I really thought I impressed her was that night. She was standing in this big old long line for the bathroom at the after party. And I was like, oh, you don't know about the secret bathroom? And she's like, what? There's a secret bathroom? I was like, oh, follow me. I'm in. This is going to be my manager. But then she moved to New York, and it never happened. Oh, I was so close.
Good try, though.
So I'm going to pause here for a minute because I want to ask you a big question. But first, I'm going to invite Joe, my producer, on the podcast for the first time ever. How you doing, Joe?
Hello.
Dan, you met Joe earlier.
Yeah. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Dan.
I dropped off with Joe a couple bottles of Burley. What flavors did I give you, Joe?
I have the Real Deal Root Beer Soda Syrup. A shrub syrup that's Mandarin elderflower.
Okay, and shrub is like an old-timey drink that has some vinegar in it.
Yeah.
Which one are you going to go with?
I'm going to do the root beer. I'm going to go with the suggestion on the side of the bottle to add a little whiskey to it.
Okay, so you're going to have a liquor, easy drink.
So I'm going to be 1 ounce of syrup, 2 ounce of spirit. In this case, it's a Jim Beam that I've infused with anise. And some seltzer water.
Dan, have you ever had a shrub?
I haven't, but I'm actually, when Joe was mentioning it, I brought up the Burley website here, and I'm going to try and find that stuff around here.
I will get some for you, Dan.
Oh, cool.
Don't forget to use your code.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
J rules with a Z.
With a Z, yeah.
All right. So I'm pouring myself one, too. You're using canned bubbly water, right, Joe?
I am, yes.
And I used my little soda machine there and made some soda water. I'm trying the smooth ginger beer. They also have a super spicy ginger ale. But this is their less spicy ginger beer.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, it's awesome.
So is it taste like regular root beer, or does it taste different?
Well, mine's got the booze in it, but it's got it's definitely like good root beer flavor, you know? Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. It's awesome.
Cool.
Awesome sponsor.
Yeah. I want more sponsors that give us free stuff. If anyone makes any sort of vegan snack foods and they want to sponsor us. And I'd love to get to where we can send some of this to our guests so they don't just have to sit and listen to us enjoy it. Let me tell you, Dan, this is really good, really wet in my whistle.
It sounds great.
Well, I'll say it goes really well with the bourbon. It's a good suggestion.
Yeah, I know that they use these in bars to make gourmet drinks. But like I said last week, I also think, like, as a non-drinker, it's really cool when you go somewhere and they offer you something other than like a can of Coke as your, you know, non-drinker option. When they're like, well, I can make you a shrub. I'm like, ooh, can you? You fancy. So,
Well, cheers.
Cheers. Thanks for joining me. Get back in the shadows where you belong.
Bye.
That is my producer, Joe Honner. Dan, I wanted to ask you how much things changed around there when Disney bought Pixar. Because Disney and Pixar had such a strong relationship already. Like, was it a big difference?
It wasn't huge initially. It was really interesting because there were we did really well. Because there were three studios around the country who were kind of in a similar position, who had written their own software and were doing computer animation. One was Pacific Data Images that was down here in Silicon Valley. Another one was Blue Sky Studios back in New York.
Now them I know.
And well, you've heard of the PDI indirectly because they got bought by DreamWorks.
Them I know, yeah.
But they both of them wanted to make a feature film, and they both had to sell their studios. So Fox bought Blue Sky, and DreamWorks bought PDI. And it's kind of crazy, you know, the way the business world comes around, because then Disney bought Fox, and now Fox and Blue Sky and Lucasfilm and Pixar, you know, are all under the same Disney umbrella, but it's crazy that way. But, you know, it's just like they had to give up their studio. We had Steve Jobs negotiating our contract. So Toy Story, our first film, we got 50-50 co-branding and 50-50 co-ownership where they had – it was 50-50, but they had controlling the 50%.
Gotcha.
But, you know, we didn't lose the studio to do it, and we kept it. And then he finally sold – at a high, you know, so they had to pay through the nose for it. Made him rich, but and I have to admit, I had a little stock. I did okay, but he went on their board, and Steve Jobs did, and then they right. also they were having at the time they were Disney Feature Animation was going through some tough times. They were their stuff wasn't very good in the early 2000s, frankly. They were
they definitely hit a rough patch there.
And they put our people, they put John Lasseter and Ed Catmull as president, you know, Ed Catmull as president and John Lasseter's chief creative over Disney Feature Animation as well as Pixar Animation.
Right, because around that time you start seeing John Lasseter's name on everything.
Yeah, he's always executive producer on everything. But their movie started getting better. Although I remember the first one that came out underneath that was Bolt or something. And for a Pixar person looking at it, it's like, oh, that looks like something they put in because they thought John would like it. Oh, that looks like something they put in because they thought John would like it. But
I actually really like Bolt. I've watched it multiple times.
And it's a good film. But there's things like that you can see they were trying to please. Because they'd been in a structure where it was really top down, and Pixar's philosophy is really director-driven, where the directors get notes, but it's up to them what to do about it. And so Disney got better for it, but it also kind of weakened the involvement from those people. So it changed things a bit. Any good-sized company, there's always change, and there's been change, and it's the being connected to Disney kind of gives it a direction. But it also, you know, gives us an outlet. We're doing pretty well, you know, under Disney. They, as long as, you know, the movies are good and do fairly well out there, they leave us alone pretty much.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Which it's great when a large corporation is smart enough to let people keep doing the thing that they bought the people for to begin with.
Yeah, before we were bought, the head of Disney was what's that guy's name? Michael Eisner.
Eisner, yeah.
Yeah, and he didn't have a good relationship with Steve Jobs. You know, they kind of didn't like each other. And so he didn't want to sell to Eisner. And Eisner was very much of a feature films as cash cows kind of guy. But the guy who took over for him, Bob Iger, who is recently stepping aside and handing over to the next guy, Bob Chapek. But Iger, you know, came and talked to us around the time of the – and he said he went to like one of the Disney parades at one of the parks in like Asia and looked at the parade. And everything in the parade that was Disney was like classic Disney from decades ago. And anything recent – was Pixar. And right. And it kind of went through his head. It's like, you know, we're really dependent on these guys. These guys know what they're doing. And he had a really interesting career because he had started ESPN and got bought by ABC and then was at ABC and got bought by Disney. So he had been taken over a couple of times. So he knew what it was like. And so he had a very good relationship with Jobs and treated us with a lot of respect.
So let me ask you about a movie where you had a different credit. La Luna, which I just rewatched tonight. Beautiful cool. film.
I
rewatched it to get ready for this. You were the supervising technical director on that one.
Yep.
What does that entail?
Well, that's basically... you're kind of the director's right-hand man in charge of all of the technical details of getting it made.
Okay.
And I was – for that film, we worked on it. There was a little bit of story work before, but the production of it was pretty much a year. And there were only three people that were on full time that whole year. Enrico Casarosa, the director, AJ Reebley, the production manager, and me. You know, I was on the whole time for a whole year for 7 minutes of animation. And then people would come on, and, you know, I start off, I'm all by myself. I'm looking at this, the story reels that they have and stuff, and say, okay, I need a boat. I need a hammer. I need a ladder, you know, and just, and start, you know, trying to figure out, oh, how many shots do we have and where do they, you know, and start, you know, breaking it down to what we need. And then as people become available, you know, the first modeler I got was a young guy that wasn't all that experienced. So, okay, I'll start him off on the hammer, you know, that's small. And later on I got somebody really good. It's like, okay, you do the boat, you know? And, you know, just people come on, and then the people would go off, you know, they'd finish their models and they'd move on to another feature film, and I'd get somebody on to shade it and stuff, and get effects guys to do the rope and the water and all of this stuff. But then they'd leave and there'd be something to fix. And I guess I'm the guy. I got to go in. So I cut my fingers into everything technical about that that movie, because, you know, I was just all, you know, if the other people were gone, I was the one left to figure it out.
And how'd you like that?
I loved it.
Yeah.
Look, I'm just really proud of we had done a lot of shorts before, but the that one had more story in it than any of the, you know, most of the shorts we had done in the past tended to be set up for a gag, you know, and it was a good gag and a good setup, you know, right. But it was just this very short thing. This one, like, there's characters and they're going through changes, and, you know,
it was growth in the kid and the different ways that you symbolize it, like him. Both of them want him to wear his hat the way they wear their hat.
Yeah. Yep.
So the point where he turns his hat backwards, you're like, oh, he's got a third way.
Yeah, he's got his own. Yeah. And then at the end, they've got their own brooms and he's got a rake. You
and
know,
he's got a rake. Right. Yeah,
like, just there's he's finding his way.
I loved it. Yeah. And it's also gorgeous to look at.
Well, thank you. And I was chosen as the as a technical director there, because they were very worried about getting the look. And Enrico was a storyboard artist, but he's very good at watercolors. And he had done watercolor versions of the storyboards that were really beautiful. And they wanted to, like, well, we got to get that kind of feel in there. So we did a lot of stuff to try and get that look. Like some of the things that are wood. We had this Belinda von Valkenburg was working with me on it. We worked together on Ratatouille before that. But she would, like, paint watercolor of wood grain, and then we put that on, and then we'd put, you know, if it was painted over that, we'd paint over that, and, you know, it just, but that we did a lot with real watercolors and then scan it in and play with it. So just to get that feel.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's interesting. And it played before Brave.
Yeah, it actually, it was interesting because we were done way early for that. We were done a year early, and it got scored as a kind of a bonus feature with Michael Giacchino at the tail end of Cars 2, I guess it was. And so we were done early, and then they let us show it at animation festivals. So it opened actually a year before that in Annecy, France. Annecy has this big animation festival every year.
Oh, fun.
So got to go to that. And I got to go to a bunch of festivals with it, even before it opened on Brave. So
what was the response like?
Oh, it was great. I gave a talk at Annecy, and then I went to in Stuttgart, they have this slightly more tech animation festival, FMX. I gave a talk there, and the guy there said, you know, who was there from Bucharest, said, oh, come to our animation festival in Bucharest to give this talk, you know. So, yeah, I talked in, you know, Denmark and the UK and all this stuff, you know, to giving my La Luna talk, which is a great opportunity.
Yeah, that's awesome. Are you going to do any more technical directing?
Well, you know, I've kind of – like I said, I've been there 32 years and I wasn't a spring chicken when I started there. And I've kind of, you know, stepped back a little bit And, you know, just the technical stuff gives me my own time and things. But I miss it. So it's kind of, I'd like to do some more on that creative end. But I'm currently in a place where I just, you know, straight tech. Although I did, you know, I don't think I think I mentioned to you the book project I worked on.
Yeah. For Make-A-Wish. Thank you for reminding me. Tell me about that. When was that?
It's a couple of years ago now, but my wife had done, it is from Nashville, and she did, had this company there doing writing workshops. And through that, she was connected to the nonprofit network. And there was this little girl in Nashville who was, you know, born with a serious heart condition, whose Make-A-Wish wish was to have a picture book of her life. And my wife, you know, lined up a writer she knew there to interview her. And we went over and visited with the family, you know, and did some interviewing. Okay. But the writer interviewed her in detail and wrote up some text. And I said, okay, now we need to get it illustrated. Who are we going to have illustrated? And I said, well, I know a place where there's a bunch of artists.
They were going to get paid to there, yeah.
And I didn't realize when I was doing, when I said that, that I was volunteering to be a producer. So I ended up working with this fellow, Noah Klosek, who's a production designer at Pixar, who's done a bunch of children's books and knows about it. But he had just got his production designer gig on the film Onward. It was busy as crazy. So we'd spend an hour out in the Pixar atrium for a while going over stuff, and then I'd go off and do more and then come back and check with him. And, you know, he kept it on the rails, and I had to fill in a lot of gaps. And then we put out a message for artists. We had to get about 20 people, you know, drawing pages. Some of them did drawing and coloring. Some of them just did the drawings, and other people would color them. And
so
I ended up coloring.
So it was a really big production to make this picture.
Yeah, just this little kid's picture book. But there's a whole bunch of people. And it's just, since it's for the kid, we credit it to the girl Zoe Jones with Wendy Martin, the writer. And the only place you find the Pixar people is way at the back. They're volunteer artists from Pixar Animation Studios, and there's about 20 names. You know? But it was really a lot of fun to do. And I was through the whole process from visiting her to handing it off to the Ingram Publishing to having the presentation ceremony in Nashville and handing it to the girl. It was a lot of fun. Zoe's heart.
And then she opened it up and she was like, ugh, what is this?
Oh, the color is pink. I hate pink. Yeah. No, they loved it. The family loved it.
Oh, that's wonderful. And then all that work. And was there a single copy or was it actually also published? I mean, how?
Yeah. Well, it's through Ingram Publishing, which has this print on demand thing. Okay. So that, like, you get it on there, and it's on Amazon, it's on Barnes and Noble, you know, it's just about anybody that sells books online. You can find Zoe's Heart.
Zoe's Heart. Yeah. Very cool. You mentioned Onward, and I want to tell you, the last time that I saw you, I had a housewarming party in January.
Oh, yeah.
None of us knew that we were having maybe our last get together before we'd all be locked in our homes.
I know. I'm glad we went. Jeez.
But I like I always do, like I'm resisting doing on the podcast because I know you can't answer. But whenever I talk to you, I'm like, what are you guys doing? What are you working on? And I think that Onward was already done at that point. But you're like, oh, we have this thing coming. You're going to love it. But Onward had to be released during the pandemic.
Yeah. And it was really unfortunate because it got hit by it. It opened in theaters, but they were already closing up, and then they just switched it to streaming. And we really took a hit, you know, financially from that.
Oh, that's a shame. It was fantastic.
Yeah, it was a fun film. But Soul just came out, and they put it out on Disney Plus as kind of a try to get people. And they just talked to us about the number of people are watching it. And they have all these metrics, that, like the number of people who watch it the first time, the first thing that after they subscribe, number of people watch it multiple times, and, you know, stuff like that. And it's doing really well because people just love it.
Well, anyone listening, don't sleep on Onward. Go back and watch that. Yeah, everybody's watching Soul because, like you said, it got a hyped release. Onward, they were just scrambling.
Plus, Soul is really timely for the, you know, that's just the moment, you know, with the racial stuff and just a lot. But Onward is, and if you had a brother, you should see Onward, definitely.
Yeah, it's super, super fun. I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you, out of the shorts, the features and everything, do you have a favorite Pixar project?
Well, I mean, they're always colored by what I did on them. And so my favorites would be like La Luna, because I just lived it for a year and then talked about it after. And Ratatouille, which I had, that's the only feature film where my name is up in the cards instead of the crawl, as they say. You know, I was a shading supervisor there, in charge of all the shading for all the environments and the characters, and had a great team. And I just loved that, that project. And, you know, beyond that, it's very often, the favorite is the last one I watched.
right. I think I work that way as well. Thank you so much for joining me. It's always a pleasure to chat with you, Dan. I look forward to when we can hang out in person again. Actually, as soon as I have a chance, I want to come back to Emeryville and do the tour again.
Yeah. And yeah, if you're ever down in the South Bay for whatever, it's something, yeah, just happy to see you.
Awesome.
I'm looking forward to going back to the studio too. Well, we don't know when we're going to be back.
Yeah. So, well, we're going to do that New Year's Day get together every year, we decided. Okay. And then COVID decided otherwise, but you have a standing invitation. People can find you on Facebook, Daniel Stephen McCoy.
Yeah, if you look for that.
On Instagram, just I McCoy, is that correct?
Yeah.
Twitter at DS McCoy. Yep. Why something different on every platform, Dan? Are you
It has to do, it's a long story, but I'm a McCoy was really a joke when I first got a Mac and did a Mac.com address. I'm McCoy, you know, but I left that behind and started using DS McCoy when I can.
All right, so your DS McCoy.medium.com is your website.
Yeah, that's I do a little writing there once in a while. Don't have a lot up, but I write some pieces there.
Awesome.
How my car got towed away in San Francisco and stuff.
So. Oh, I got to go check it out. Maybe that'll be a Pixar short someday. Dan's car. I've been your host, Keith Lowell Jensen. My producer is Joe Honner, and our original art was done by Joe Honner. Our editor, audio engineer is Jack Matrenga. Joe and Jack are with Hyperpixel. Hyperpixel is a production company with a focus on digital marketing and e-commerce, offering daily management of your website, social media accounts, and digital marketing campaigns. Our music was done by DJ Real. And once again, thank you so much to our sponsor, Burley Beverages. Go to burleybeverages.com and enter KLJ Rules with a Z instead of an S, and you will get 15% off your order. Or if you're in Sacramento, you can go visit them at their tasting room. I don't think you can actually do any tasting. You have to wear a mask, but you can buy bottles and see how it's made. And they're great people. Thank you so much. And we will see you next week here on the Keith Lowell Jensen Show, presented by Keith Lowell Jensen, hosted by Keith Lowell Jensen, or something like that. Yeah!